Much. So some of my disqualifiers have already been said for me. So I'm very, very pleased and honored to be able to speak at Jack's 60th birthday. So I was asked to maybe shed light on on the Langlands program and in the ways it might reflect on homotopy theory. Sadly, I don't actually know much about either of them. So I did some homework and I'll try to tell you a little bit about the Langlands program, but what I'm going to try to talk more about is the geometric Langlands program, which perhaps is not completely orthogonal to the subject. There's some connections or some structures that you see appearing that might be relevant. And then I'll try to say a little bit about how you might apply this geometric Langlands philosophy to study representations of real groups. Okay, so everything I'm going to say is going to be very cartoonish. So I'm going to give this very sort of impressionistic picture of some things in representation theory. So please feel free to interrupt and tell me where I got it completely wrong, and also just ask a lot of questions. But I'm going to start from just what is representation theory, sort of. So we start with I'm going to start with a group. Representation theory asks us to study something like some kind of space. G hat, which is going to be some kind of space, or at least sets for now, of irreducible, and I'm going to mostly think about complex representations of the group G. What we'd like to do is try to describe the set in some reasonable way, and try to apply it to contexts in which the group G appears. So, for example, just to be silly here, we have S1, we have the representations are given by the integers. And so if I'd like, maybe I'd call this the e to the I n x. These are the irreducible representations. So S1's abelian, so these are all one-dimensional representations. For example, I could look at the group R and try to study if I'm studying real representations, I have the group R again as a representation. Or maybe I should think of the complex representations, which is e to the I tx. Great. So far, good. So what are we trying to do in representation theory? One thing is to just describe, give this description of a set. What you could do more than that is, let's say at least in the case where we have an abelian group, we have a stronger statement, which is we have a Fourier transform. And what does the Fourier transform say? It says that we can decompose functions on the group. We decompose functions on the group in terms of some kind of functions on the dual group. So in the abelian case, this is actually the dual space of the group. So the Fourier transform tells us, for example, that any function on S1 can be written in the basis of the e to the i n x's. It tells us that any function on R can be written in the basis of the e to the i t x's. So you're already seeing the cartoonish level here. I'm going to be ignoring what do I mean by functions. So there are many different classes of functions. There's a whole aspect to representation theory with functional analysis, which is which function spaces do you try to realize this in. And I'll ignore those aspects completely. But the way we want to think about the way I want to think about the Fourier transform is that we have this is my dual space, R hat, and given a point here, given by something t, I can think of it, think of the delta function at the point t. So that's the kind of function I'm looking at. To the delta function as t, I can assign the function e to the ipx, complex valued function on R, and these form the basis. You can write any function in terms of this, where basis here means in a continuous sense. That's what the Fourier transform does. Okay, so delta functions correspond to the characters, the special functions here, which are the characters of the group. Another thing we might note is that if you have a group like S1 or R, if you take irreducible representations corresponding to two different points here, this label is irreducible representation. If you take two different ones, there's no non-trivial extensions between them. And so I've really described not just the set of irreducible representations, I've really described the category of representations. Take a representation and decompose it as direct sum or direct integral of these irreducibles. So that's good. Now, what are we going to do in general? So for general group G, we'd like to classify this dual group, or what actually appears much more in nature is we have a particular subgroup of G, gamma, and I'm looking at some function space on G mod gamma, and on this we have the action of the group, and I'd like to say not just abstractly classify all the irreducibles of G, but what are the irreducibles that appear in here, and I could call that, for example, G hat sub gamma. So try to describe the kind of spectrum of this particular representation of G and decompose this. Great. So how do you do that? So what's a useful technique to study representations of this group? Gamma is a subgroup. This is all just sort of schematics. So you take a subgroup of G and you look at the homogeneous space and you have the right action of G. That's a representation. For example, we can think of L2. Gamma is going to be a discrete subgroup in a minute. We're going to be looking at L2 functions and look at this action and decompose it, see what appears in there. So one technique I wanted to advertise was the technique of Hecke algebras. So what's the technique of Hecke algebras? So you fix your favorite subgroup K inside of G. So we have a group K inside of G. And what we're going to say is instead of trying to classify, here we were trying to classify all of these representations, and that might be really hard. And what I want to do is look only at those representations that have a K invariant vector. So this is kind of a generalized version of highest weight theory. You want to look at all those representations that happen to have a vector invariant under the group K. And so if you have a representation, if V is a representation and it has a vector that's invariant under the group K, then something actually acts on this space of representation rather than trying to act on the whole group on this whole huge representation like L2 of G mod gamma. We're going to look at this much smaller subspace, a space of K-invariant vectors, and see what acts on here. And there's a general prescription to what acts on here, and it's called the Hecke algebra for the group G and the subgroup K. So it's sort of the piece of the action which respects K-invariant vectors. And what this is nothing but functions on double coset space. So that's sort of in the abstract algebra context. In a more geometric context, if I look at G mod gamma, I'm looking at what does it mean K invariant vectors. My representation was realized in some function space, right? Looking at some function space. So a K invariant vector means a function that's K invariant. So that means I'm really looking at functions on here which are K invariant, which means functions on the double quotient space. Okay? Now once I've passed through this quotient space, the group G no longer acts. You no longer have an action of G from here, but what you do have is you have correspondences. You have a whole bunch of correspondences given by the set K, G, or K, kind of, right. So K mod G mod K is not a group anymore, but it acts. You take a vector in here, you lift it to G mod gamma, you act by your group element, then you project back. That gives a well-defined subset here. So K mod G mod K doesn't act on the space, but it will act by functions. If I have, I don't know, let's call delta in K mod G mod K, then I get a certain correspondence living, let's call the delta correspondence living, so it's just a subset. Correspondence here is just a subset of the product, and you can take a function, pull it back, and integrate it down. So this is in the usual upper half plane picture. This is take a function and integrate it around a small circle around each point. Okay, so the point is that on this space function gamma k, there's a certain algebra, namely this Hecke algebra acts. Okay, so this is sort of some abstract prescription that you can always do. Now, what do you want to apply this to? I guess I want to say just K mod G mod K sits on inside of here. Is that what I want to say? I guess I want to look at the product. This is K mod G mod K. Right, to put it into words, if I have an element, let me think of having an element in K mod G mod K. Think of that as a delta function on k mod g mod k, I pick a representative of that coset, and then that representative can act on the space. It doesn't take a point to a point, it takes a point to a subset. So maybe I should just give the example. If you look at the upper half plane, you look at SL2R modulo SL2, you look at the upper half plane, the double cosets of SL2R and SL2 are given by positive real number. And so for each point in the upper half plane, you have a circle around it, which is things of a given radius, R around it. And this operator corresponding to that R is just average your function along those small circles. Okay. So, all right. So, I mean, you could just think of it maybe as the top line. This is some abstract algebra statement. What acts on K invariants in any representation? The answer is functions on double cosets. Okay. So, now what do you want to apply this to? Well, what do we want to apply? We want K, what kind of, I mean, I made up K. This was my question. What K do I want to use? Well, I want K to be big because I want to have lots of K invariant vectors. If I don't have a K invariant vector to act on, this doesn't help me. So we have K invariants. On the other hand, we want, K to be small. Right? Small group has lots of invariants. You want K to be small, so we have lots of K invariants. On the other hand, you want K to be big so that the double coset space, this Heck algebra, functions on the double coset space, is something you can understand. So the smaller this thing is, the more chance you have at actually describing this algebra. And then in good cases, you have representations with K invariant vectors are going to be equivalent to representations of the Heck algebra for G sub K, and the map is just to take V to the invariants. So that's what, this is sort of the paradigm. Does that make any sense? Okay, so that's sort of how we want to approach representation theory in this kind of context. Any questions? Okay, so now let's start. There's some kind of balance between what we can do and what we'd like to do. Okay, so now let's start talking about the Langlands program. So what is the Langlands program? So the Langlands program in this cartoon version. Langlands program is this kind of representation there, this kind of harmonic analysis, is describing the harmonic analysis for certain kinds of groups, for groups over local fields, and over adelic fields. And it tells you a prescription of what happens when you look at certain homogeneous spaces like this. So G is going to be one of these groups. So let's start with the kind of the warm-up that lets you proceed. My group is going to be, let's say, GLN over QP. I want to study representation theory of GLN over QP. And right now, I don't have a particular gamma so far. So I'm just going to try to study just the representations of GLN of QP. And so how do I approach GLN of QP? Well, I need to find a subgroup K. And so a good K, so this is going to be my G, a great K is GLN of ZP. This is a subgroup here. And this is going to be a wonderful pair. So this subgroup is lots of representations won't have, certainly this is doesn't work all the time, but if you do have a representation which has a K invariant vector, then you're in good shape because the Heck algebra for GK, which is called, in this case, it's called the spherical Heck algebra, is actually commutative. So this is sort of the first miracle in the Langlands program, the first thing that helps you get somewhere. So this algebra is functions on this double coset space, QP, GLN, ZP, G. GLN's VP, and you can classify what this algebra is. Maybe let me tell you what the answer is for general group G. So for general G, for G is a semi-simple algebraic group. I'm going to look at this Hecke algebra for G of QP, or reductive, I guess, with respect to G of ZP. So for example, GLN. And there's a beautiful theorem called the Satake isomorphism, which tells you that this algebra is actually, not only is it commutative, it's actually the representation ring of a certain complex algebraic group. This is just a representation ring of a group which we'll call G check. This is, maybe I should put over C just to emphasize, this is a certain complex algebraic great group. Why complex? I should have emphasized everywhere that I didn't tell you what functions are, but all my functions are complex valued. I was looking at complex representations. Functions everywhere here are complex valued functions. So this is some complex algebra made out of some complex valued functions, and it's isomorphic to this thing. And as we know from just Lie theory, this space is actually functions. This is polynomial functions. The representation ring of a semi-simple Lie group is just polynomial functions on the space of semi-simple conjugacy classes in this group, G6G, also, or if you'd like, take the maximal torus of this group modulo its Lie group. Okay, so what is this magical group? This is called the Langlands dual group. And rather than tell you that, well, the definition is basically you take all the root and weight data that you use to define a semi-simple Lie group, and you just dualize all of them. Rather than going into that in detail, you just make a chart. You look at G and you look at G check, and suppose your group was GLN, then the dual group is also GLN. So that makes life easy. If your group was SLN, for example, the dual group becomes PGLN. And more generally, if you look at the S, let's see, so if I have SO odd, get exchange with the SP evens. And the SO evens are self-dual. So this is sort of the schematics of the Langlands dual group. Now, why is this thing so useful for representation theory? Because now I've I have a classification. This is sort of the first step of the classification of representations of a p-adic group. So if I take so let me try to state this, and then I'll start accelerating. So what does this tell you? That if you have V, a representation of G of QP with a G of ZP fixed vector, let me say an irreducible, and this is what's called unramified, then I can assign to it the space of G of ZP invariant vectors. This space is a module over this Hecke algebra. In fact, it's one-dimensional module, if your representation is irreducible. Well, why is it one-dimensional? You take this representation of G of QP, you take its invariance, that's a module over this Hecke algebra. This Hecke algebra is just commutative algebra. So an irreducible representation of a commutative algebra is just a one-dimensional vector space. And if you have a commutative algebra, one-dimensional representation is just determined by a character. And so this is determined, so this is just, since this is functions on this quotient, a character of this algebra, what is the character of functions? It's just given by a point, right? Now the commutative algebra, this is the algebra of functions on a space. What does it mean, a character of this commutative algebra of polynomials on a space? It just corresponds to a point in T check mod W, which means a semi-simple semisimple conjugacy class in this Langlands dual group. Okay, do people follow this? Okay, so the claim is that representations of irreducible and unramified representations of this group are given by a single semisimple conjugacy class in G-check. And I'd like to think of a semisimple conjugacy class in G-check as a map from Z to G-check. A homomorphism from Z to G-check, which happens to land in something semisimple. You have a homomorphism from Z to G-check up to conjugacy, which happens to land in something semisimple. And then finally, the final observation is that Z, so what does this Z come? Langlands tell you to think of this Z in the following funny way. Z is the quotient of the local Galois group of QP. So you look at Galois group of QP bar over QP, more precisely the Vey group, and there's a quotient. So I'm gonna ignore Vey versus Galois if you let me. So if you look at Galois group of QP bar over QP, if you have an extension of QP bar, you look at the residue field, you get an extension of the residue field, and that's given by a power of Frobenius element. So this surjects onto Z, and then what I'm given is a map from Z to G-check. Okay, so the reason I did all of this was to explain that how representations of this p-adic group become, at the end of the day, characterized by complex representations. So, for example, let me take this G equals GLN, then all I have here is an n-dimensional complex representation of Galois QP bar over QP, which just happened to factor through this Z. So this is the first case of the local Langlands conjecture. It tells you that certain representations are parameterized by these are going to be, in the end, infinite dimensional representations of a p-adic group are given by just n-dimensional complex representations of a Galois group. Okay. So this is sort of the basic thing in the Langlands philosophy. This is sort of where you get started. So now are there questions about this before I? Okay, so now what does Langlands conjectures tell you more generally? They are going to tell you how to fit this. Well, what the Langlands conjecture roughly say is how to understand all the representation theory of a GLN over QP or G over QP in terms of Galois data, and more generally how to look at all the representations of adelic groups. So, should I skip that del? Okay, so maybe I could say roughly that the local Langlands conjecture says, let me say it for GLN where it's actually a theorem due to Harris, Taylor, so the Langlands conjecture for GLN, and I'm going to misstate it, but at least to get the gist, is that irreducible, and there's an adjective here which is called admissible, which means reasonable, appropriate sense, representations of GLN of QP are in certain bijection with so-called admissible, again, so there's some conditions on here that I'm ignoring, but admissible representations of Galois group of QP bar over QP into the Langlands dual group over C, which in my case is GLN. The places where I'm lying, if you're concerned, is that this is actually shouldn't be the Galois group, it should be the Vey group, actually it shouldn't be the Vey group, it should be the Vey-Dalin group. So you slightly modify this. But sort of in spirit, this is sort of the gist of the conjecture. So this is sort of what the Langlands conjecture says. That was the wrong word. Explained to you, I sort of proved this outlined the proof in the case of unramified representations, and those happen to be representations which is factored through the quotient of this. So now maybe I could say in two words what the global Langlands conjecture is. So the global Langlands conjecture says similarly. So the basic idea of Langlands conjectures is that harmonic analysis for groups like this are given by Galois data. In other words, if you want to describe this G hat, the dual group, for something like G over QP, or an adelic group, the dual side is given by some Galois theory. That's sort of the Langlands philosophy in one sentence. Hope no one's terribly offended here.
Is there a version of this where there's some group of units in some division
algebra? Okay, so here's where my ignorance comes. My understanding is that the way this is proven is in a very, I mean, this is a very hard thing to prove, and the way you prove it is using the fact that you realize this Galois group and you realize the GLN of QP, and you realize in addition a division group of units in division algebra, all acting on the cohomology of essentially these Lubin tape moduli spaces, which I guess this is where the relevant to the rest of the conference is. And then you decompose, you look at all three of those are acting in there, and you decompose that according to the action of all three, and then that's where you find the matching. But I think in the actual conjecture, you don't need the group of units. Am I mixing together the forms? Yes. Right. And yes, exactly. Thank you. I'm lumping together all the forms here. Let me maybe say it in the real case where I think I know the statement better, and that'll maybe clear it up. So in the real case, so there's a real local Langlands, which is actually a theorem for any group. This is a theorem for, you can imagine, just replacing GLN by GN, G-check. In the real case, local Langlands was actually proven by Langlands. And in that case, it says that if you have a real Lie group, so you have just a real Lie group, not necessarily compact, and I'd like to study, then it says that if I look at irreducible, again, there's some adjective admissible, for example, unitary representations of the real group, and here, this set ends up being not actually so nice to parameterize. You can put conditions, but what you do is a union M of some multiplicities over real forms of the complexified group. So what you actually end up parameterizing together is a collection of real forms that are all in the same inner class. So there's an inner class of real forms, and with some multiplicities, actually. Each representation appears a certain number of times. But this set is exactly... So I think now I'm actually stating a correct statement, which is this is in bijections with representation from the vague group of R to the L group, where here the vague group is an extension of the Galois group, which of C over R, which is Z mod 2 by C star. And the L group is a complex... This is, again, a complex group... but it's an extension by Z mod 2 of the thing you had before. Okay, so this is sort of, and this is probably better, this is a correct statement, I think. So this is, tells you what representations of real group. For example, all the unitary representations here are classified, except they're sitting inside of this classification. Might be hard to say which ones they are, but this gives you a classification of all reasonable representations of a real group. And it's fairly concrete data. You can spell out what these representations are. There's just some pair of some semi-simple elements of the Lie algebra and some element of the group, which squares to exp of lambda, et cetera. You can just spell this out. So this is some very concrete classification. Okay. So that's, again, so maybe that's where the division algebra comes in. I'm not sure. It's sort of that you get all these forms coming up together. So maybe, I don't know, maybe we don't actually need the global Langlands conjecture, but I guess we can state it anyway. So what is the global Langlands? Just in the same spirit of everything else we're saying, I'm going to look at the Adels. Let me just do Q. This works, same thing. You can formulate the same thing for number field or function field. And it's even known for function field. So the dels are sort of, you take the restricted product of the of your QPs, this looks roughly right. So you take the product of your QPs over all P, where the restricted product means that all but finitely many are in ZP. And now my group G in this case is going to be, that I'm going to be studying, is going to be your favorite, say GLN, or some other algebraic group over the adels. So this is the group that I want to do harmonic analysis for. And the amazing thing about the Langlands program is it tells you the harmonic analysis for this group, which is a question in pure question representation theory, sort of contains enormous amounts of number theory. So more precisely, I'm going to look at the space G of the adels. So G here is my algebraic group, modulo G of the rationals. The rationals sit inside of here diagonally. And I look at functions on this, more precisely L2. And I look at the action of this adel group on here. And now I want to decompose this. I want to do this harmonic analysis, describe what the decomposition of this is. And Langlands conjecture tells you that this decomposition, that these the irreducible representations that appear inside of this decomposition are essentially in bijection. And this is sort of where the subtlety is to get the precise statement. But essentially, it's in bijection with representation of the Galois group of Q bar over Q into this complex Lie group. So in case of GLN, this would be, I guess I wrote GLN. So in the case of GLN, you're looking at n-dimensional complex representations of the Galois group of Q bar over Q. So that's a fairly easy object to define. And the claim is that it's, so the funny thing is that this is somehow, the flow of information somehow is supposed to go this way. But somehow it does. But you're looking at the harmonic analysis of this group, and it's supposed to be labeled by this. And this labeling is compatible with this local Langlands conjecture. Maybe I should just say a sentence about that. The way you kind of match these two things up is using this spherical Heck algebra, this unramified representation story, which I told before, this GLN of QP and GLN of ZP. So the claim is that if you have an irreducible, so the point is that if you have an irreducible representation, if pi is an irreducible representation inside that sits inside of here, then it actually decomposes as a tensor product over all primes of pi sub p, which are irreducible representations of the group over the local field, and a real factor, of course. And the claim is that for all but finitely many p, this is an unramified representation. It's one of the easy ones we said in the beginning that you can study with these easy commutative Heck algebra. So at all but finitely many primes, you know exactly what you're doing. It's just a character of this simple commutative algebra, which you already know matches semi-simple conjugacy class or conjugacy class of Frobenius on the dual side. You already have this easy case of local Langlands. And this kind of gives you a compatibility. How should you match those two things up? You should match it in a way compatible with these local Langlands correspondences. You know sort of what's going on at each prime, or at least you know in all the easy primes where you just have these unramified things, and that somehow ends up being enough. Okay, so everyone understands the Langlands program? Yes, great. perfect. And then you just have to prove it. And so since we are very far from being able to do that, we do the following thing, which is ask a different question. And maybe there's several ways to motivate doing this. And rather than just throwing it out of the blue, one question I could ask, which I hope to get back to, is you can ask in this story, unlike in the case of the group S1, if you have representations of a real group, this is not a semi-simple category. Just knowing the list of irreducibles is very far from knowing all the representation theory. There's lots of extensions. The category of representations of this group is much more complicated than you'd get from just looking at this list. So that's one thing. You could try to ask, is there some kind of categorical harmonic analysis you can do? Is there some way to describe categories of representations rather than just lists of representations? So there is actually approaches for real groups. Maybe I should comment. There's this there's a fancy version of the Borel-Weil theorem. The Borel-Weil theorem. So this is a sidebar, and please ignore it if you're. So Borel-Weil theorem, in its fanciest version, says that representations of a real Lie group are completely described. The category of representation are completely given in terms of geometry. Borel-Weil theorem tells you how to realize finite-dimensional representations of a compact Lie group in terms of flag manifolds. There's a fancy version which says that the whole category of representations can be written in terms of GR equivariant sheaves on the flag manifold, which is the complex group mod the Borel, or if you'd like, the compact form modulo the torus. So you look at this group acting on here, and you study the orbits of this group, and you look at sheaves that are constant along these orbits, and this is, I should probably put some names next to it. This is Balanchine, Bernstein, Kashiwara, and Schmidt. Anyway, so you could say there are answers. There are geometric answers to category representations, but it's very far from this. So it's very hard to say, for example, how does this have anything to do with the Langlands parameterization? How do these orbits match up at all with this Langlands picture of representations? And that's sort of, I don't know, I guess it's known in some form, but it's very unclear. Okay, so that's some motivation. So you'd like to understand how these two match up in the real case. You'd also like to match up how to describe categories of representations. And there's a whole list of other motivations, but at this point we completely change gears. And we go to the geometric Langlands program. And the geometric Langlands program, maybe one way to say it is, so what is the geometric Langlands program? Geometric Langlands is it's a categorical analog. It's a categorical analog of the Langlands program, of this Langlands harmonic analysis. It's kind of a categorical harmonic analysis, but on geometric. It lives on geometric analogs of this space, G of Vadels modulo G of rationals. So you change the space, but you enrich, and you make the space much easier. You're going to look at much easier spaces, but you're going to make the statements much stronger. Okay. I could say maybe inside of algebraic geometry. So the main question I'd like to explain about this is, maybe I should leave this one. So here's the first question to start is, what do you mean by functional analysis? So I wrote functions all along here, and if everyone had in mind some of their favorite spatial functions, smooth functions, Schwarz functions, distributions, L2. What's going to be sort of the categorical analog of function spaces? And what you can ask, why do you? Well, maybe I won't ask why you want that. Let's suppose we want that, for lack of time. So the question is, if you have functions on a space X or a space M, what's the analog of function spaces in algebraic geometry? How do you do functional analysis in algebraic geometry? Polynomial functions on algebraic variety are clearly not the right answer. They have none of the structure or richness of, you know, space of L2 functions on a homogeneous space. So they're not the right answer. So you can ask, what is the right answer? And so the right answer for what? What do you want out of a function space? Well, what were we doing in representation theory with function spaces? One thing you can say is you want things like Fourier transforms. You'd like to be able to identify function spaces have some kind of dualities, for example, of function spaces, things like the Fourier transform. More generally, you can look at action. The other thing we were doing in this Hecke story was you'd like to have action of correspondences. So what do I really end up doing in functional analysis a lot of the time? I have a space M, I have a space N, I have a space M cross N, and I have a kernel function, K of XY, is a kernel function on M cross N. I take a function on M, pull it back to here, multiply by the kernel, and integrate down. Right? So Fourier transform in most of the operations that I want can be written as I take my function, think of it as a function up here, multiply it by the kernel, and integrate down to N. Okay. So you'd like to be able to do things like this. And that's sort of, let's claim that this is really all you need in some sense. Okay, so what's the analog? Well, there's a clear answer, which is you want to look, instead of spaces of functions, you look at categories of sheaves. And really, when I say categories, I should really mean derived categories. So this is sort of a proposed answer for the analog of function space. Now, I didn't tell you what kind of sheaves. I didn't tell you exactly which kind of derived category I mean. But then again, I didn't tell you what functions were either. So functional analysis consists of studying different classes. This is at least what Dernfeld calls functional analysis, is studying different versions of derived categories of sheaves on a manifold and trying to describe them. Well, trying to describe them would be the harmonic analysis story. So if you have a sheaf, you can do Fourier transforms. You can do actions of correspondences. If I have M cross N, and I have a diagram like this, and if, for example, I take a sheaf or complex of sheaves on the product, I can write down the same Fourier, the same integral kernel type picture. I take a sheaf, I pull it back, I tensor it with this integral kernel, and I take some push forward. And so this is the analog of a convolution, if you want, with a kernel in algebraic geometry. Right. Right. I think I probably learned this from him, too. So, I mean, this is sort of the, I guess in some sense he was doing some kind of infinite dimensional functional analysis in some version. Maybe I should mention the most famous example of this kind of thing is this is called the Fourier-Mukai transform. It's sort of the analog of the Fourier transform, which says that if you have an abelian variety, or just think of elliptic curve, actually that's the case I want. So I take an abelian variety, and I take, or maybe I should think of this as, for example, being the Jacobian of some Riemann surface. Think of the Jacobian of a Riemann surface and look at the dual abelian variety, which in this case also happens to be the Jacobian of X, but you can just do it for any abelian variety. The dual abelian variety I can think of actually as line bundles on A. It's one way to describe the dual abelian variety. It's a space of line bundles on A. So what that means is that on the product, I get a universal sheaf called the Poincaré sheaf. What does this mean? A point in A check gives you a line bundle on A. And so as you vary the point, you get a line bundle on the product. Okay. So that's the Poincaré sheaf. And Mukai discovered that if you write this diagram, you get you think of this thing as somehow being the analog of e to the ixt in some categorical sense, and you get an equivalence from the derived category of A to the derived category of A check. And this is the Fourier transform for coherent, so here, by here I mean coherent sheaves. So there are many kinds of sheaves I could be doing this kind of story to. Here I mean coherent sheaves. And you think, what is this doing? Well, what was the Fourier transform doing? It was writing any function as a direct integral of exponentials. What is this doing? You're writing any sheaf, so you write any sheaf on A as a direct integral in some appropriate, well, in this sense, whatever that means, direct integral of line bundles. So it's kind of a spectral analysis for sheaves on an abelian variety. You write them as kind of an integral of line levels. That's what this Fourier-Mukai transform is doing. So this already tells us that we're in the right right direction, that we can do some kind of, we have correspondences and we can actually produce some Fourier analysis. We can actually prove some equivalences. Okay, so now, is there questions about functional analysis? Yeah, so this is, So the point is that now once you have the Fourier transform, you sort of at least can start thinking about a Langlands conjecture. Fourier transform is sort of somehow the baby case of the Langlands correspondence. So now you can try to set up. So geometric Langlands is a special case of this kind of harmonic analysis. This kind of harmonic analysis means you have your favorite space, like Lubin-Tate moduli space or something, and you have some category of sheaves on it, and you want to describe it in some good way under the action of some natural operators. But geometric Langlands does this in a particular context. So let me just try to state what does geometric Langlands do. It says we're going to replace all the stuff we had before. The number field Q we had before gets replaced by X, a Riemann surface. So you pass from a number field to a function field, if you like. So I'm going to have a Riemann surface. And I'm going to have now the Galois group of Q bar over Q. This gets replaced. Galois groups we think of as fundamental groups. So I think a fundamental group of X, maybe I'm going to look minus a bunch of points. Or maybe I'll just do the easiest case where I just look at the fundamental group of X itself. Ideally, you'd like to understand what happens when you remove a whole bunch of points. But now I'll do sort of the unramified version. So fundamental groups are analogs of Galois groups. What's the analog of these p-adic groups? Well, think of p-adics as little Laurent series in P. This tells us to think of C of Laurent series in T, which is sort of the algebraic version of the loop group. So very, very small little Laurent loops into G. So that's going to be my version, mine meaning Drinfeld's, version of the p-adic group. And what's going to replace, and so then the main question is what replaces this adelic quotient, and there's a nice answer to that. So while this adelic quotient, this g of the adels mod g of q, and if you maybe mod out by some bunch of G of ZPs, because I was looking at vectors invariant under these anyway most of the time. So let me maybe only at most primes, maybe. What's the analog of this? Well, this sometimes has an interpretation as points of an algebraic variety, in case of Shimura varieties. But luckily, in the function field case, we're really lucky. And this has a complete analog, which is the space, the moduli space, of G bundles on X. So you should think of this Adel group as a whole bunch of trivialization data. You take a G bundle on a Riemann surface, you trivialize it on a little neighborhood of every point, and then you write down a whole bunch of transition functions. So this is a whole huge collection of transition functions for a G bundle on a Riemann surface, and then you mod out by all the choices you had to make. So this is the space. So what we'd like to do is do harmonic analysis on bound G of X for some kind of versions of p-adic groups, or at least for the Hecke algebra. So remember here, what we had was this Hecke algebra of G of QP and G of ZP. And this was the easy one. This was the commutative Hecke algebra, which enables to get started. This is actually almost as far as people have gone in the geometric languages. Haven't gotten much further than this easiest one. Well, this was supposed to be functions. This was functions on this double quotient. Of ZP mod G of ZP. So what does it happen? What happens in geometric Langlands? Instead of functions, we have sheaves. And instead of double quotient, of course, I could just put one of these up here and say they're invariant functions. So here would be sheaves that are equivariant with respect to positive half of the loop group. on a space, which is the loop group modulo its positive half. Here all my groups are complex. This space is probably familiar to most people. It's the base loop space of the maximal compact subgroup of G. Okay, so this is the space. Is that right? Roughly. So this is the, we're looking at just equivariant sheaves on this base loop space of K. And here, this was a commutative algebra. Well, here it's a category, but it's sort of a commutative algebra version of category. It's a symmetric monoidal category. Symmetric monoidal, and in fact, it's equivalent to representations of the Langlands dual group, which is, again, a symmetric monoidal category, can tensor representations. So this is called, again, the geometric Satake correspondence. And I don't have time to write all the names, but one says Lustig, Drinfeld, Ginsburg, Mirkovich, Vilonen are the names attached to that statement. Okay, so that's the setup. So now we have all the ingredients, and so maybe one can give the brief version of the what is the geometric Langlands correspondence. It just says geometric Langlands correspondence says okay. We're going to do harmonic analysis. We're going to look at the representations of this Heck algebra on functions on this space, where functions means sheaves. And we're going to decompose it. What does the Langlands philosophy tell us? That when you decompose this thing, it should have to do with Galois theory. So it's going to have to do, what is Galois theory? My Galois group is pi 1. So I should be studying representations of pi 1 into the Langlands dual group. And what is the representation of pi 1? Representation of pi 1 into a group is a locally constant. It's a flat connect, it's a bundle with a flat connection, or locally constant sheaf. Okay, so let me say that. So that's sort of a lot to handle, but that tells you what the conjecture should be. And roughly, the conjecture says geometric Langlands conjecture says that all these things hold, like you do all this analog of the, at least the unramified pi derived Langlands, then it works. So you look at the derived category of bun G X, the space of G bundles on a Riemann surface. And again, I'm not telling you exactly which derived, which, so you can think of it as perverse sheaves or various versions, but let's, some function space on here. And it tells you that this should be equivalent to, well, on the dual side, we're supposed to have Galois group representations. So we look at functions on Galois group representations. So this is pi 1 of x mapping to G check, or also known as G check bundles with a flat connection. So the geometric Langlands conjecture says that there's a Fourier transform that tells you how to do harmonic analysis on this space. But if you're looking at some derived category, and I'll write some words here, which you can ignore, you look at some derived category on here, and it tells you that it's given by sheaves on the space. I wrote coherent in small letters. But on the space of G-check bundles on X with flat, this is everything is on the Riemann surface with a flat connection. What does this mean? Why is this harmonic analysis? This says that if you pick your favorite gadget in here, let's call it rho, it corresponds to some particular sheaf. Let's call it K sub rho. So each one is supposed to, each particular G bundle with a flat connection labels a particular function on this side, which you should think of as the analog of an exponential function. These are my constituents of my harmonic analysis. And that every function on here can be written as a direct integral of these basic functions. So it's the strongest version of harmonic analysis. Of course, I've ignored my Heck operators. Really, what I should say is that this is somehow, and I didn't actually spell it out in the usual Langlands case either, but this is compatibly with Heck operators. So I have this tensor category representations of G check, and it acts on both sides, and you make this compatible with that. So that's the geometric Langlands conjecture. It, It said perverse. It's a derived category of constructible sheaves, or if you like, the basic constituents are perverse sheaves. So that the function theory is very different on the two sides. Here I'm thinking about coherent sheaves, and here I'm thinking about constructible sheaves. But they're playing different roles. And there's a long story. You can say why perverse sheaves are somehow good analogs of functions in the setting, but in some sense it's not necessary. So I guess I'm out of time. So I wanted to say something about, maybe I should just, if you allow me to say two sentences about something I'm trying to think about, sort of out of context here, but well, anyway. So what I would like to do is understand this picture. So we have the picture that was above, and joint work with that we're doing with David Nadler. We have this conjecture that says that picture above, the representation theory of the real Lie groups, actually sits inside of this geometric Langlands conjecture. You could say that the category of representations of this real Lie group, and again, you're going to take a union over a bunch of inner forms, a bunch of different real forms of the same group. So in the Langlands program told us how to parametrize these. Langlands theorem told us that these were parametrized by a certain set. Now, what we conjecture is that there's a geometric Langlands version of this, which actually gives you the entire category of representations and sort of explains the relation with this Borel-Weil theorem. So what that says is that this is given by maybe the... It's derived category of flat Dirac bundles, or GL bundles, on the Mobius strip. So somehow... this is sort of the I have no time left version, that if you try to do this geometric Langlands correspondence on real Riemann surfaces, real Riemann surfaces with a real structure, you look at algebraic curves that have a real involution. So I'm really thinking of the Mobius strip as P1 minus 0 and infinity modulo a real structure, which is the antipodal map. So somehow if you do geometric Langlands with real groups and real bundles, and you do it in this particular case of the Mobius strip, you actually get a description of these categories of real representations. You get the entire category structure. And in fact, you get them exactly with their kind of, maybe I could say, in their Borel-Weil representation. Somehow one side of Langlands program exactly reproduces this kind of, you know, GR orbits on flag varieties. That's the bundle side. And the other side ends up giving the Langlands parameters. This is a conjecture, but okay, thank you.